several times during the meditation. It was a really quiet, deep group. I was very impressed. What I want to talk about tonight is Sakaya Ditti, which means views of self. And I'd like to talk about it first from the standpoint of Western psychology and then a little bit about the same thing from the standpoint of Buddhism, Buddhist practice. The Buddha said that attachment to fixed views of self is one of the chief causes of human suffering. And when I first heard this as a therapist, it stood out for me, because every week I talk to a lot of people who know completely who they are and what their life is about and so on. And I often feel, you know, you'd be better off if you didn't know that, didn't know so much. Most of us, I think, have a kind of story of our lives, the story of me. And the outline of that story is so similar for so many people. It starts with a sense of deficiency, lack, something I don't have, something I wasn't given, something that's wrong with me. And then the story of me is about fixing that. And my life is about my attempts to become whole, become complete, become whatever I'm supposed to be. And those deficiencies usually are, well, those are the beliefs that about who we are. And one of the things that Western psychology has come to understand is that our ideas about who we are almost doomed to be faulty because of what I think of as design flaws in the human brain and nervous system. The first one being that we form most of our ideas about who we are in very early childhood. And that's when we have the least experience, when our brains are least developed, and our ideas tend to be sweeping and general, and we have the least data to base them on. And the other thing, another thing is that as children, we are all self-centric. I don't mean selfish. I think it's a misnomer to think of, it's a misunderstanding to think of children as selfish. Children are actually highly altruistic, highly interested in the people around them and their well-being. Infants as young as 18 months have been observed trying to wipe the tears away from their mother and comfort her when she's crying. There's a natural tendency to want to help and to love and to want to be connected. But they're self-centric in the sense that they tend to think that whatever is happening around them is about them in some way. So, if, for instance, it's natural for children, if their parents are getting a divorce, to think, well, they're getting a divorce because I was a bad kid. That's a perfectly reasonable idea for a very young child to think. Whatever's happening is about me. Children care about the people around them and are highly motivated to make them happy, but have very unrealistic ideas about how much they can affect the people around them. If mom's depressed, I ought to be able to cheer her up. So because of this self-centric stuff and the exaggerated sense of their ability to affect other people, we are all highly susceptible to irrational guilt, to feeling that we have somehow failed to do what we're supposed to do for other people. We're all kind of set up for it. Let me give an example of a hypothetical person who's sort of made up and sort of not. I'll call her Lisa. Lisa grew up in a single-parent family. Her mother was seriously depressed. And she's cyclothymic. She'd go in and out of it. And so some days she couldn't get out of bed. Some days she'd be kind of happy and cheerful. Some days she'd be okay. And Lisa's job, she knew, was to make her mother happy. So she tries everything she can to cheer her up. She bees good, quiet. She tries being cute, funny, you know. And nothing really works that well. I mean, sometimes her mother cheers up a little bit and she thinks she's found the key, but then the next day her mother's back in the black hole again, so she has failed. So that this is the origin of her guilt feelings. It's called childhood omnipotence guilt is the technical term for it. So she grows up with some what are called pathogenic beliefs. Here are some of them. I cannot make other people happy, or I make other people unhappy. I am a burden and a disappointment to others. I'm selfish. This is a belief that a lot of people have, a deep, dark secret that many people have. Is if people really knew, they'd know how selfish I am. She's selfish because when she tries to meet her needs or get her mother to meet her needs, often her mother looks pained and burdened. So she thinks, you know, if I didn't have these needs, I'd be easier to parent. So her need, you know, so she can't distinguish between self-care and selfish. She's just a selfish person. She also believes that to be happy is to abandon her mother. Because when she's cheerful and happy and enjoying life, she's most emotionally distant from her mother. She feels the most apart. And she feels that she's leaving her behind. So it's a kind of an act of betrayal for her to be happy. Now, these beliefs are unconscious, not in the Freudian sense of repressed, but in the sense that breathing is unconscious most of the time. We're always thinking them, so we're never quite aware that we're thinking them. They're kind of in the background. The result of these beliefs is that Lisa stays isolated and alone most of her adult life until she comes into therapy because she doesn't want to inflict herself on other people. She wants a romantic connection. She wants friends, but she's a burden to people. She hurts them. It's an altruistic act. She protects people by staying alone. And so based on completely faulty beliefs, she keeps herself emotionally starved. So her views of self are quite damaging. One of the most common or most successful, I guess, ways of responding to these kind of issues is cognitive therapy, which is, you know, a well-researched form of psychotherapy that does seem to be very helpful to a lot of people. The motto of cognitive therapy could be, don't believe everything you think. You know, it's a process of studying the mind and studying your ideas, the background ideas that govern your behavior, and questioning them. This is not a very easy process to do because of, again, some of the design flaws in the human brain. The brain evolved to believe itself. That means when we've had a belief for a long time, it starts to just feel like common sense. It's obviously true, self-evidently true. It feels that way. And if someone contradicts it or says it, questions it, we think. And we also give more weight to evidence that supports our current beliefs than to evidence which doesn't. And then again, the other thing is that most of our beliefs tend to be unconscious. We're not aware we're thinking. Lisa didn't know when she came into therapy that she thought had these ideas consciously. They seem stupid to her, but they govern her behavior nonetheless. So studying the mind in this way takes a lot of commitment, a lot of energy. Therapists will often have patients keep a notebook with them. And every time their mood changes, like if they become anxious or depressed, the instruction is to stop and ask themselves, what were they thinking? Because the self-talk has been going on in the background. And usually if you ask yourself what you've been thinking, you can recover a lot of what was going on in the last 5 minutes. And by exploring this inner self-talk and writing these things down, you begin to be able to abstract from what you're hearing what Howie likes to call your top 10 tunes, the beliefs that cause your suffering. In my experience, I like the term top 10 tunes. I think it's kind of funny, but I've never met anyone who had 10. It's really interesting. If people have pathogenic beliefs, it's maybe 4 at most. or, you know, variations of just a few, which is kind of surprising. So the treatment, once the beliefs are made explicit, is called disputation, which means that you, with the therapist and with yourself, you begin saying, well, is this really true? What's the evidence that it's true? What's the evidence that it isn't true? So you begin to question these things and to look at the beliefs with your adult mind rather than, continue to operate with basically what was the child mind. And this is a very successful form of treatment. I do it. I think it's very helpful. But... and the other thing I should say is that in recent years, last 15 years or so, cognitive therapists are now using mindfulness in their work, because to become quiet and just watch the mind is a very helpful adjunct to cognitive therapy, because instead of relating from your beliefs, you start to relate to them, right? You know what I'm saying? Instead of being pushed around by them, you start to see what they are and that you start to have them more in front of you. So it's a tool for becoming more aware. So that's great. They are beginning to mine Eastern wisdom in Western psychotherapy, but they've gone about this deep. I think one of the drawbacks of cognitive therapy is that while it's helpful, it tends to foster the notion that in order to be happy, we have to fight with our minds. We have to dispute and disconfirm our beliefs. We have to win in some sense. We have to struggle with our minds. And pretty dangerous. You tend to lose when you fight with your mind, I think. To get into practice a little bit, one of the first things that people learn when they begin to meditate is that they can't control their thoughts. Anyone have that experience? I mean, you sit down to meditate and, you look around and everyone else looks like they're in formless samadhi, but your mind is restless and it's going every which way. And this is very startling. This is why so many people think they can't meditate, right? But the lesson there is that there's no one at the helm, that thoughts arise according to lawful conditions like lightning or wind. They are impersonal phenomena. The idea that there's some thinker in there, right, running the show is a delusion. You can't ever, you meditate, you can't find that person who's supposed to be, running things. So we can't control our thoughts because there's no thinker. The idea of a thinker is just another view of self. And cognitive therapy generally doesn't challenge the idea that there is a thinker separate from the thoughts, but Buddhist practice does. So when you begin to discover that no one's running the show, it can sound very depressing and even hopeless at first, but it's actually the doorway to freedom. One of the most common views of self is that I am my mind. I mean, in the Western world, we don't necessarily think we're our bodies. We have bodies. If I lose my arm, I'm still me. But if I lose my mind, if I lose my memory, there's a belief that I'm being diminished. I don't exist anymore, or don't exist as much. We are our minds. In deep meditation, what you can do with thoughts, what is encouraged, is to imagine, say, that your mind is like a cloud, it's like the sky, and thoughts are like clouds floating by. You can't push the clouds, you can't push them out of the way, you just watch them come and go. They're not me. And what begins to happen as you get this is that you begin to be a lot less tormented by your thoughts. They're phenomena that arise according to conditioning. They rise, they pass away. We don't have to take them so seriously. So that rather than dispute every idea, we sort of let them go. I mean, disputation helps and so on, but this is a little deeper in my opinion. Sometimes the cognitive therapy is a preliminary, but I think this is the deeper practice. To show what I mean, I want to compare two ideas. I want to do a little experiment. Ask you to think two different ideas. If you want, you can close your eyes to focus and concentrate on this. But I'm going to ask you to think an idea and to notice what happens when you think it. The idea is, I am a loser. Just think that idea for a minute. Notice what happens in your body when you think it. You tense up. What happens? What happens to your in your feelings? And then let go of the idea. Shake free of it. And let's think another idea. The idea is, the thought, I am a loser, is arising. Notice what happens in your body and in your feelings when you think that idea. Okay. Do you see a difference? I mean, in the first idea, you've got a view of self. I am this. I am this, you know. In the second idea, you are merely describing phenomena that arise. And there's not a sense of identification with them. And I think when you begin dismantle, that's a good enough word. That's not the one I was thinking of, but it's the same idea. Oh, I think so. You begin to understand that the ideas about who you are just that. They're just ideas. They are a construction. We construct an identity and we hold it together. And you begin to see deeply into the nature of the ego, of this being that we think we are. Here's a kind of a long quote from the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. So the ego, then, is the absence of true knowledge of who we really are, together with its result, a doomed clutching on at all costs to a cobbled together and makeshift image of ourselves, an inevitably chameleon charlatan self that keeps changing and has to keep alive the fiction of its existence. Ego is then defined as incessant movements of grasping at a delusional notion of I and mine, self and other, and all the concepts, ideas, desires, and activity that will sustain that false construction. The fact that we need to grasp at all and go on and on grasping shows that in the depths of our being, we know that the self does not inherently exist. And they go on. The ego's greatest triumph is to inveigle us into believing its best interests are our best interests, and even into identifying our very survival with its own. This is a savage irony, considering that ego and its grasping are the root of all our suffering. Yet ego is so convincing, and we have been its dupe for so long, that the thought that we might ever become egoless terrifies us. I remember when I first confronted the doctrine of anatta, of non-self, I was scared to death. I thought if I believed it, I'd disappear, you know. The idea we cling, we there's a terror of letting go of our constructions of who we are. And so the question that then arises for me is there anything beyond this, anything beyond the mind? And one of the things that as meditation deepens that you begin to notice is you begin to notice that thoughts, feelings, sensations are arising in something. They arise in our awareness, right? And as the mind becomes quieter and you begin to be able to become aware of awareness, you begin to understand this really strange thing, or not understand it, but really appreciate it, that awareness is completely unlike anything else in the universe. One of the peculiarities of awareness is that you notice that it is completely unaffected by its contents. This is a tremendous fact. It's obvious, given some examples. The awareness of fire isn't hot. The awareness of light is no brighter than the awareness of darkness. The awareness of a star isn't bigger than the awareness of a molecule. Pretty obvious, right? But if we bring it home, it's also true, if you pay attention, that the awareness of fear is not itself afraid. The awareness of anger is not itself angry. And the awareness of suffering doesn't suffer. I think this is a truth of really, really tremendous importance, because what it means is that there's a part of us that's always free. I mean, that no matter what we have suffered in our lives, there really is some part of us, the most intimate part of us, which has never been touched by any of it. I find that amazing. And freeing. Let's do another little thought experiment. Keeping in mind your awareness, you can close your eyes if you want to again, don't have to. And just become aware of being aware. Become aware of this background of all our experience, this thing that contains our experience but is not contained by it. And then think the thought, I am free. And then let go of free and just think, I am. And then let go of am and just think, I. Now, let go of I. And just rest in natural being. This awareness is available to us at any time. Most of us miss it most of the time because we're so busy paying attention to the contents of awareness that we get lost. We don't remember that there is a natural freedom. But it's so easy to come home again. That's the tragedy of human life in many ways, that freedom is like this close. I'm going to close with a couple of quotes, and then we might have a few minutes for stuff, for talking. Here's a quote from Rumi. Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. When the soul lies down in that grass, the world is too full to talk about. Ideas, language, even the phrase each other, doesn't make any sense. When we become identified more with the awareness behind our experience, this begins to make more sense. And then finally, here's one of Howie's favorite quotes. One of mine too, from Kalu Rinpoche. We live in illusion and the appearance of things. There is a reality. You are that reality. When you understand this, you see that you are nothing. And being nothing, you are everything. That is all. We have a few minutes for questions, comments, discussion, if anyone would like to speak. Yes. Deconstruction, that's what I was...
Oh, right.
That's the word I was looking for.
It hit me really, really hard, which was a gift, but it was very overwhelming at the time. And since then, I've been trying to find resources, such as readings, and everything I find on deconstruction itself is like these research articles, or you know, it seems like it's more... technical than easy. And I'm just wondering if there's any articles, books, videos, anything online that you would recommend just to talk to a layman about deconstruction itself.
So the question was, can I recommend resources to understand
deconstruction?
No, I think that this... Well, the term deconstruction is kind of a philosophical concept. It's really not used that much. I mean, deconstruction is what they do in French philosophy, you know, which is, I can't even begin to comprehend.
That was the term a couple of teachers gave to me. I haven't heard it before, but I don't do a lot of reading.
Yeah, well, I don't. I mean, I'm behind the times, too.
Yeah.
So, but if you want to read about cognitive therapy is actually a very simple procedure. Oh, you teach it, okay.
So it's more like emptiness and absence of self from a Buddhist perspective.
I'm drawing a blank. I don't know that it's very useful. I don't read much about it. I love these kind of quotes, and I've read some of the suttas and stuff, but generally speaking, it's to be experienced rather than thought about, because we can think about it forever. There's been probably a mountain of literature written on the subject of emptiness.
Yeah.
And emptiness is just another idea. You could easily say fullness. People do, you know, the absolute or the emptiness. I mean, those are words that are pointing to something that has to be experienced but cannot really be thought about. Just like awareness. Nobody understands what awareness is. I mean, people try to think they do, try to explain it. But we are awareness. So we intimately understand what it is, even when we can't put it into words. There are many things we can know that we can't say. Am I saying, you know? The heart knows many things that the head can never understand, and it's that deeper knowing that practice fosters. I grew up, I'm a thinking type. You know, I grew up with all these ideas, and I think most of them have not been very helpful. They're pointing at the moon, but they're not. You know, so the real work is to become quiet and simply see, and then what you're going to know, you know.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm glad that was... Yes?
So I'm fairly new to this, so I understand
So the question is it correct to understand that we are the observer behind the spectacle of life? Is that, yeah. Okay, yes and no would be the answer, as it is. You always get answers like that in Buddhism. The idea that I am the observer is another view of self, right? So if I hold on to, I am awareness, I, Tom Moon, am awareness, I've misunderstood it, really. Because if you pay attention to your awareness, notice awareness, and ask yourself, does it belong to anybody? The answer that I find is no, it doesn't belong, it's just there. And my awareness is no different from anybody else's. So, yeah, I'm pure awareness. I like that idea. That's one of the least painful views of self to hold. You know, it'll cause you the least trouble of all the ones I know. But is it strictly true? Well, does awareness have a self? Is awareness anybody? You know, and so I would say yes and no. Sir,
get your hand. So there was a lot of discussion about awareness and also mindfulness. Mm-hmm. But what's where you're talking about, you know, it seems like awareness is beyond mindfulness, because mindfulness involves like thought, right? Interaction at some level.
Are you asking, are awareness and mindfulness different?
Well, yeah, like should mindfulness be really awarenessness?
That's a very good question. I don't know the answer exactly. Mindfulness is a practice in which the idea is to become aware of being aware. I mean, that's really what it's about. But we're aware a lot of the time without being aware that we're aware. I mean, awareness is happening all the time. I think even in deep sleep, there's a certain amount of awareness. So it's all, sort of always there. But in the human brain, it seems to have the capacity to turn on itself and know itself. And that is something we practice. That isn't automatic. In fact, it kind of goes against the stream, I think. We have to work at it. Does that help at all? So I see awareness is the more general thing, and mindfulness is a practice. Of becoming aware of being aware.
So if mindfulness is trying to become aware of your awareness.
Yeah, that's how I see it anyway. Becoming present to your experience and knowing you're present to your experience. So if you're thinking, you know you're thinking. If you're feeling, you know you're feeling. So that you don't get lost in your experience. Because it's very weird. We're aware all the time. While we're unconscious, we're unconscious. We behave so automatically most of the time, so we're unconscious. But we are aware. It's very weird. You know what I mean? No, I don't either. Sir. Yes. So the question is kind of, do I think there's something about the human condition that there's some inherent goal to become aware? My answer would be, it depends on which day you catch me. I love thinking about these things. And sometimes it feels like there's some process of evolution going on that's not Darwinian, where we are evolving toward greater awareness. I find that thought comforting. I like that thought. Sometimes I believe it. I don't really know for sure. I often feel, too, that there is some kind of saving principle in the universe. There's something that calls this, we're not just pushed from behind, there's something that calls us forward toward greater, whatever, greater understanding and so on. I sense that sometimes. I don't know whether that's a delusion or not. And I love to speculate about these things, you know. I like to speculate that awareness is the field in which the whole universe arises and passes away. That's a standard Hindu view, you know, of awareness. I love these ideas. And what Howie has taught me, because I talk about this stuff with him all the time, is that I don't have to know. That all I need to know is this moment, this life, you know, and what is in front of me. That I can work with, and I don't that I can live and don't know and don't need beliefs, even though I have beliefs. You know, some days I believe in rebirth, and some days I don't. But what I like about this is that I don't have to clutch beliefs in order to feel like I'm safe or happy. Like, that's the problem with most religion, right? Does that help? Okay. That's my opinion about it all. Yes?
Society and world, and because that infant can't articulate it. But I think in some ways when we are born, we're aware of being aware.
Yeah, it's what you're saying, when we're born, aren't we just aware of being aware? We have this purity really that gets kind of beaten out of us by life and by conditioning and the verbal world we live in.
Is that? I think a child is very aware.
They certainly look aware, and there's an energy that draws us to them, right? There's a joy that is quite natural and quite, in my opinion, quite mysterious. Yeah, in many ways, I think that is true. We're trying to get back to the simplicity of being children as adults. Or think about dogs. I mean, I've been working many years to try to come into the present in the way that my dog never leaves. He's just there. He's just here all the time, responding to the present. And same with babies, yes. So there are these beings around who teach us because they're simply present, you know. I think the dog doesn't have awareness of awareness. I don't really know, but, you know, babies and our pets are often our spiritual teachers or our live-in therapists. I think we're out of time. Oh, we've gone over a little bit. Let's see, two things. If you have questions or comments or anything and want to talk, I'll stick around here for a while. The other thing is, you mentioned that I write this column, The Examined Life. It comes out biweekly. If you want to be on the mailing list and just have it sent to you, there's a sign-up sheet back there. You'll get a 500-word column every other week, and you won't get any puppy pictures or political rants or anything, just the column. So if you want to do that, you can sign up and I'll put you on the list. Well, it's always a privilege to be here. I really feel honored to be asked to come and to share this, these ideas with you. So thank you all.
Thank you very much.
Oh.